Welcome to Inspiration and Transformation from the Banks of the Ganga with Sadhvi Bhagwati Saraswati, an American sannyasi living at the Parmarth Nikatan Ashram in Rishikesh, India. Sadhvi is president of the Divine Shakti Foundation, a charitable organization bringing education, vocational training, upliftment, and empowerment programs to women and children. Sadhvi is also Secretary General of the Global Interfaith WASH Alliance and Director of the world-famous International Yoga Festival. Join the musings of an American sannyasi as Sadhvi shares the wisdom and teachings of her guru, His Holiness Pujya Swami Chidanand Saraswatiji.
Welcome, everyone, to Inspiration and Transformation from the Holy Banks of the sacred Ganga River in the land of Rishikesh, India. Most of us think of surrender as something that means you've lost. You tried, you failed, so you surrender. And so it has this real negative component to it. It also has a negative component to it, or rather negative feel to it, because we also think it's very weak. That you tried, you failed, you're not strong enough to keep fighting, and so you surrender. So it has this implication of being both a failure, a loss, and also being weak. Surrender is the opposite. Surrender is the strongest decision we can make. But in order to realize that, we have to first look at the illusion that we live in. So we have to first look at what's the alternative to surrender. So, okay, if you say, I'm not going to surrender, I'm so strong in that illusory concept of strength, meaning I'm going to keep fighting, I'm not going to surrender. So if in your mind you think, I'm so strong, I'm not going to surrender, I'm going to keep fighting. If we really look at that, what we realize is, I'm already a slave. I am giving up my peace of mind, my spiritual connection, my ability to realize the actual truth, the real truth, in service of some desire, some yearning, some urge, some indoctrinated concept of what I should do or what I should have. I'll give you an example. Let's say I decide that my goal, my calling, what I want, is to be a basketball player for the LA Lakers. Okay? I want the LA Lakers should hire me. Forget it, they don't even have to pay me. I'll play for free. Nonetheless, they should have me on the team and I should be playing ball, not in the take your grandmother to the court day, but in their actual real games, I should be playing for the LA Lakers. Now, I could practice dribbling and making baskets from morning till night every day. And because of the karmic package that I am in, my particular unique karmic package at this particularly uniquely special intersection of time and space. I am 48, almost 49. I am female. I am about 5'2½", barely, if I'm standing up very straight. There is no way that no matter how much I practice, no matter what great trainers I get, that on anything other than take your grandmother to the court day, the LA Lakers are going to put me as part of their team. Now, but if I'm attached to that, like that is what I have to achieve. That is the cool thing to do. That's the successful thing to do. I'm going to be miserable. Maybe I practice for a few years, it doesn't work, it doesn't happen. I then have two choices, going back to our question on surrender. Either I surrender. I say, okay, God, not as a failure, not as a loss, but as a pure acceptance of the beauty of my karmic package, despite the fact that it doesn't include playing for the LA Lakers. But being able to accept that beauty of who I am, of what skills I do have, what opportunities I do have, what dharma I have, what purpose I have. Being able to really accept that beauty, being able to accept the beauty of 49 years of experience and joy on planet Earth that doesn't go with getting hired to play for the LA Lakers, but nonetheless is exquisitely beautiful. And so either I choose to surrender, saying, okay, this isn't going to happen, and I embrace with love and gratitude and awareness and acceptance, the absolute beauty of the karmic package I'm in, of the laws of the universe. Or I don't surrender and I keep fighting. I'm gonna make it happen. No, I'm not. I could fight with them all I wanted. I could fight with the NBA all I wanted. I could file discrimination lawsuits that they're discriminating against 5'2", 49-year-old females. I could do whatever I wanted. And there is still no way, again, that on anything short of like a charity day, or a carnival day, or something that doesn't actually count, that I would be playing for the LA Lakers. So what have I achieved by refusing to surrender? Nothing other than keeping myself from acceptance, from joy, from freedom to actually know who I am, because that refusal to surrender means I'm attached to an illusion. It means on some warped level, I am unable to see why I'm not a perfect fit for the Lakers. It means I'm attached to some illusory way of looking at the world. And so surrendering is actually the decision of strength. Surrendering is the decision that says, oh God, thank you for these 49 years of experience. Thank you for this beautiful experience as a female, as a 5'2" female. Thank you for all of the gifts that I have in this life, and help me understand how to use them in service. It also, refusing to surrender is depriving myself of actual awareness, an actual truth. Because what it is it is saying to myself, and to the world, of course, but to myself, it says, I am my career. I am my age, my size. I am that particular achievement or that particular title. I am either the successful basketball player or the one who's going to be forced to surrender, but I'll never surrender. And so I've created an identity that has nothing to do with truth, nothing to do with a genderless, ageless, sizeless, abilityless truth. Or rather, you could say a genderful, ageful, skillful, right? Because I'm either none of it or I'm all of it. That's the truth of the self. When we speak about the capital S self, the soul, spirit, consciousness, it's infinite. It is the divine. It's both the creator and the creation. It's the simultaneous everythingness and nothingness. And so every time I allow myself to get attached to an identity, it pulls me out of awareness of the truth of who I am. And so surrender says not I'm a failure, not I've lost, but rather I have recognized in my wisdom, my spiritual wisdom, I have recognized the futility of losing my peace, losing my grounding, losing my truth, losing my freedom in this attachment to a particular role, a particular title, a particular outcome. And so the real surrender is the most powerful choice. And surrender does not mean I give up. What surrender says is, oh God, I have tried it my way long enough. I have micromanaged my life with a death grip on myself and on everyone around me long enough. It doesn't work. You cannot micromanage yourself into happiness or death grip squeeze yourself or people around you into love, into awakening. You can't squeeze it. You can't micromanage it. The only place any of that exists is in freedom, in expansion. Surrender is expansion. Surrender is the recognition of an intelligence, a wisdom, an experience that is much more than this physical body and that I am part of. So it's not I'm surrendering to someone else. When we think negatively, you think, oh, fine, I surrender. Like you and I are fighting over a cookie. I say, fine, forget it, you can have it. I surrender. I've surrendered to you as a separate being. Either I get the cookie or you get the cookie. Fine, I give up. You have it. We all know this when we have fights with people in our lives. We say, fine, I give up, I surrender. We're still holding a grudge inside. Inside, what we're saying is, you're stupid, you're impossible, you're so annoying, you've got such an ego. Fine, forget it. And so surrender has got this, A, concept of separateness. I surrender to another. And that sense of giving up. Real surrender. You're not surrendering to a separate individual. You're surrendering to truth, of which you are a part. It's surrendering only your illusion. Surrendering that attachment that says, this illusion, this identity, this attachment is keeping me from living in truth. Therefore, I offer it. Oh God, I've done the micromanagement. I've done the death grip. Doesn't work. Or at least it doesn't work for what I really want. Now you guide me. We were speaking last night about Arjun being in Lord Krishna's chariot in the war of the Mahabharata. Surrender is when you literally say to God, okay, you drive my chariot. I've done the front seat driving. I've done the back seat driving long enough. There's a beautiful poem that says, as children bring their broken toys with tears for us to mend, I brought my broken dreams to God because I thought he was my friend. But then, instead of leaving him in peace to work alone, I hung around and tried to help with ways that were my own. At last, I snatched my dreams back and I cried, oh God, how could you be so slow? What could I do, he said. You never did let go. So surrender is to let go into God's hands. To realize I'm being cared for. There is a higher truth than my micromanagement. There is a higher truth than my death grip on an identity or a desire or a plan. So we surrender to truth. And it's the most positive, strong, courage requiring and courage delivering experience. Because yes, it requires courage. But as you do it, it fills you with courage. Because you realize, oh wait, I'm being carried. There's that beautiful parable of the man who's holding on for dear life to the rope. And he hears an angel, and the angel says, let go. He says, I can't let go. If I let go, I'll die. The angel says, well, then just let go with one finger. So he does. Her voice is so sweet. And slowly, slowly, this sweet talking angel convinces him to let go finger by finger until he's only got one finger now on the rope. And the angel says, let go. He says, now I really can't. Now I will plummet to my death. I have to hold on, otherwise I will fall, I'll die. But the angel convinces him, let go. And with the awareness that he was going to plummet to his death, he lets go. And he doesn't fall. And he looks down and he realizes he's been standing on solid earth the entire time. And I love that parable because that's what so many of our lives are like. We're holding on with this death grip to what we think we need, what we think we have to micromanage, without realizing, oh wait, I'm being held. I'm being carried. It's not up to me to squeeze and squeeze and squeeze. It's up to me to let go. And realize with faith, I'm being held. So that's surrender.
You're listening to OTRFM, part of the IOM Radio Network.
Being a radio host on IOM FM allows you to build your show on a rich platform with the power of the internet to fulfill your outreach goals and connect with a very specialized and global online audience, unlimited by time and distance. OM Times Radio will provide you with web relevance, a recognizable conscious brand, and with the standard of excellence that has accompanied every single
Circle of Hearts Radio is a sanctuary on the airwaves. Join me, Grandmother Alaya, in the circle on Sunday, 2 p.m. Eastern, as I share information to both enlighten and nourish your soul.
Hi, this is Christina Ricci with RAIN. Every 2 minutes, another American is sexually assaulted. If you or someone you know has been sexually assaulted, you are not alone. Help is just a call or click away through the National Sexual Assault Hotline. Please call 1-800-656-HOPE, that's H-O-P-E, or visit rain.org, that's RAINN.ORG.
Brought to you by RAIN and this station.
Welcome back to Inspiration and Transformation. I'm so glad to have you all back here with me. How is romance an obstacle on the spiritual path, that couple relationship? Well, first of all, it doesn't have to be. In the spiritual teachings, there is nothing that says you have to be a sannyasi, you have to be a monk, or you have to be a nun, or you have to be celibate. In fact, the scriptures are filled. Many, if not most, of the rishis, of the teachers, the guides in the scriptures, are actually not renunciants, but actually are householders. So it doesn't have to be an obstacle by any means. The issue is that regardless of which path we choose, we have to keep remembering that our ultimate goal is the same. The ultimate goal is to realize, not just intellectually in my mind, but actually in my experience, in the knowing of myself, my capital S self, that who I am is divine. And whether we call it awakening or enlightenment or waking up or moksha or freedom or whatever term we use for it, that's the ultimate goal, is experiencing and knowing, really knowing that who you are at the core, that highest truth is divinity. Which therefore means it is oneness with the world. That there is no place you end and the world begins. Now, we also are here, of course, in physical bodies. And the physical bodies have had histories and experiences and different karmic packages. And that is also real. But it's important not to get stuck in that. Otherwise, we think that that's all we are. And so we become like actors playing a role, forgetting that we are actually the one who has agreed to wear the costume. And it's very important at the end of the day that actors, you know, they, after the show, they take off the costume, they wash off the makeup, they go home. And they remember, I'm the actor, I'm the player of the role. And in the history of theater, or movies. I've never once heard of an actor who played a villain who actually went home and murdered his family because he forgot. But he forgot that the villain was only a role, and he, you know, over-identified with it and forgot to take it off when he went home and slaughtered his neighborhood. I've never heard of that. Ever. I mean, you think about how many commercials, TV shows, movies, theatrical productions happen all over the world. But every one of the actors and actresses remembers, I'm just playing the role. And so for us, our highest goal is to remember, oh yeah, I'm just playing this. So I'm here playing a 48-year-old female renunciant. You're over there playing something else. She's playing something else. He's playing our beloved cameraman. Everybody's playing something different. And we need to play it well, sincerely. But we also have to remember, there's this whole other reality behind the mask, behind the role. This reality that has played God knows how many roles, has worn how many masks over eternity. And so whichever path we choose in life, it's equally important that we remember what the purpose is. So when people get married, for example, Pooja Swamiji's blessing to them always is, may you walk together toward that ultimate goal of God realization. Not may you forget the ultimate goal and think that actually it's about how many toys you can buy for your children, or whether your house can be bigger than the house of the people next door. Or squeezing each other to be exactly the way you want the other one to be. Or forgetting that in the other you are supposed to be seeing God, not just an object that makes your object feel good for a few very brief moments. And so the relationship is not the problem. The romance is not the problem. The problem becomes when we think that that's all there is, that that is the point. Romance is drama, just like any other drama. And that doesn't mean it isn't fun. That doesn't mean that we are not allowed to enjoy it. By all means, enjoy it. The Sanskrit term lila means the divine play. That we're all here engaged in the lila, enjoy it. Whatever your role may be, enjoy it, play it to the fullest and best of your ability. Whether it's a mother, a wife, a nun, whatever it may be, but the attachment. So the whole teaching, and this is why relationship is a yoga, why householder phase is considered an ashram of life, to learn how to do it without the attachment. And here's an interesting secret. Just because you are celibate or a renunciant doesn't mean you are automatically freed of attachment. You still have to do the work. Simply abstaining from sensual pleasures does not, sadly, automatically remove every obstacle on the spiritual path. It would be fantastic if it did, but you still have to do the work. You can be attached to. So much, anything. In relationship, yeah, we're attached to relationship. We're attached to the physical people. We're attached to them behaving the way we want them to behave. But just because you're not having romance doesn't mean that you don't have attachments. That work of non-attachment is work for everybody. And so you all get to choose. Am I going to do that work in this ashram, in the ashram of a householder? Am I going to do it in the sannyas ashram, the renunciant? But the work is there in both places. In relationship, we mistake love for attachment. That somehow if I love you, it's inevitable I'm going to be attached. And it's not inevitable. Because the truth is, if I really deeply love you, not just the fun romance stage, not just the firecrackers, not just the passion, not just the physical ecstasy, but the real ecstasy. Not the one that very quickly goes like this. But the real ecstasy of love. Then what I really love is your essence. What I really love is your soul, your spirit. It's not about your physical body. If it's about your physical body, it's the one that goes like this. It is that attachment. You're nice to me, I love you. You're not nice to me, what happened to you? I couldn't sleep, I can't eat. I hate you, it's not fair. Right? So that's not love. That's a contract basis relationship. You do what I want, then I love you. You don't do what I want, I'm angry, I yell, I scream, I don't, whatever it may be, however our particular bargaining may work. But love is of the spirit. Love is of the soul, love is of the essence. And so, yeah, sometimes there's romance, sometimes there's drama, sometimes there's fireworks, and sometimes there isn't. Sometimes there's just stillness. Sometimes there's sickness. Sometimes there's challenges. Sometimes there's so much. But the love is that. That isn't only of the body or only of the behavior or only of the drama. It's of the essence. And when I really love the essence, then the attachment to what you say or do, it dissipates automatically. And that's how to turn relationship into yoga. That's how to walk together toward God. Is how can you use this relationship to get beyond the attachment to the physical body? To get beyond the attachment to, are you dancing according to my tune? Are you telling me what I want to hear? And to actually use it as an opportunity. To connect soul to soul, because when you do, that's real love and that's spirituality. So you can certainly use it. But yeah, it's a challenge. It's a huge challenge. It's why the path of Monasticism is always available. But don't run from it. Monasticism is not something that we should ever choose or ever walk into, because we are pushing away relationship. It's never about what I'm pushing away. It's always about what I'm embracing. So whenever people say to me, oh, should I take sannyas? I always say, not if you're doing it just to avoid the emotional or spiritual difficulties of relationship, because then you're going to have them in your celibacy. It isn't the actual act of being in relationship with someone that's the problem. It's the mind that's the problem. It's the mind that has jealousy. It's the mind that has expectations. It's the mind that wants what it wants when it wants it. And that'll just come out in a different way. If before you're ready, you renounce. So while you're walking that path of relationship, or if you know that's your dharma, to be in relationship, use it. Use it to connect with God. Within yourself, in your loved one. And in that case, use the physical expression of love as yet just another way of loving the divine creation. Because your physical body is part of the divine creation. And so for householders in relationship, the human body in that form is yet just another way of celebrating the beauty of creation. In the same way that we celebrate a sunset or we celebrate a tree. It's all creation. You celebrate the sound of beautiful music. You celebrate the fragrance of a flower. There's no spiritual teaching that says thou shalt not enjoy beautiful music. Thou shalt not smell the flowers and enjoy it. This is the exquisiteness of creation. But just don't get attached to it. When the sunset is over, don't have the mind go, when's it coming back? When's it coming back? When's it coming back? When's it coming back? I need it, I need it, I need it. That's the problem. It was a beautiful expression of creation. And then you drop back in again to the truth of who you are, that divine space, that divine truth that's beyond all this, where the sunset is inside. The smell of the flower is inside. The beautiful music is inside. All of that ecstasy is inside. Which is why the enlightened beings are so happy just sitting in caves, not dreaming about shopping sprees in London or Paris or Dubai, not dreaming of rock concerts, not dreaming of eating this food, because it's all inside. All that enjoyment, all that ecstasy, it's all inside. And that is what helps us ultimately get detached from needing it from the outside world. And you can do that in relationship. In fact, in the Indian tradition, it said that even after your householder life, after your childbearing years, you're supposed to enter into what's called vanprast ashram and then ultimately sannyas ashram. So it doesn't mean get divorced or walk away from the spouse. It's an internal shift. that even though I may still be physically with you, it's no longer about this. It's now about going inside. And so that is considered actually the dharmic transition, pathway, journey of even the path of relationship.
This is OTRFM, part of the IOM radio network.
OM Times Magazine is one of the leading online content providers of positivity, wellness, and personal empowerment. A philanthropic organization, their net proceeds are funneled to support worldwide charity initiatives via Humanity Healing International. Through their commitment to creating community and providing conscious content, they aspire to uplift humanity on a global scale. OM Times, co-creating a more conscious lifestyle.
Do you have time to read that inspiring book or that blog post you've been meaning to get to? In your busy world, how do you improve yourself and keep your life going? I'm Lisa Kay, and my Between Heaven and Earth radio show can transform your life just by listening. Be uplifted with inspiring topics, positive stories, and ideas that really work. Between Heaven and Earth radio is conscious living for your soul every Wednesday at 4 p.m. Eastern Time.
Baldwin with People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals. I grew up loving circuses and other traveling animal shows, but it never occurred to me what life might be like for the animals. Training wild animals to do things they don't understand takes force. Routine discipline with a hook or whip with the heel of a boot shows the animal exactly who's the boss. Don't patronize animal acts. Please contact People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals.
757-622-PETA.
Welcome back. This is Sadhvi Bhagavati Saraswati with Inspiration and Transformation. Is workplace spirituality or spirituality in the workplace a positive psychological construct? So is having spirituality in the workplace good for the people who work there? Good for the psychology? Of course. I can't imagine any situation in which spirituality wouldn't be extremely positive. It's interesting because I always try to get into the being of the questioner. What it is that inspires a particular question, whether it's from an aspect of pain that someone is having or trouble that someone is having, to a particular way of thinking about the world. And I think in a case like this, a lot of us think about the workplace as a place to get things done. Like, that's why we go to work, to get things done. And so maybe spirituality wouldn't necessarily be seen as such a positive element if we're focused on getting things done. And yet, it's actually the exact opposite on every level. First of all, the workplace is not so much about getting things done as getting us to be the types of people who can get things done while realizing and recognizing and experiencing that ultimately, as Pooja Swamiji says, you are the project. We focus on our projects, but he always says, remember, you are a project. And how can we, in doing our projects, remember that actually our own awareness, our own awakening, our own spiritual expansion. That is the ultimate project. And so the workplace, like the home place, last night someone had asked about relationship and romance as an impediment on the spiritual path, and I was saying, no, it's just a different place, a different way for you to unfold spiritually. Similarly with the workplace, regardless of whether you are in the workplace, in the family, in a cave, in a school, on the top of a mountain, wherever you are, your job is the same. Wake up. Realize the truth of who you are. Experience it. Know it. Live it. And so the workplace is another opportunity to do that. So number one, it's not about the things that we get done. It's about who we are as the doer of the thing. And the other piece that is a misconception that a lot of us think about, where spirituality and work don't go together, is people think, well, spirituality makes you very dull. I've had a lot of people say, well, I don't really want to be spiritual because then I'll be very bored. Or I'll be very boring, or I really like the excitement of my life, so I don't think I want to be spiritual. Now, spirituality does not by any means make you dull. Look at the enlightened masters, the rishis, the sages. And again, choose any religion. Choose anyone from any different historical period, from Paramahansa Ramakrishna, who interestingly today is actually his birthday. Choose him. Choose St. Francis of Assisi. Choose Rumi. Choose anyone of any religion. Were they boring? Are they bored? Look today at the masters, the awakened ones. Neither are they boring nor are they bored. So spirituality does not make you dull. It's the opposite. It actually pulls you out of the dullness, the numbness that thinks that the excitement of life is to be had in a nightclub, or in a party, or in a good movie, or in a bottle of an alcoholic beverage, or that's the numbness that spirituality pulls you out of. But it doesn't say anywhere, thou shalt not get things done. Thou shalt not be effective. Thou shalt live with your feet, you know, a few inches above the ground, or for a few feet above the ground in this wishy-washy, not grounded way. Because that's the other misconception about spirituality, is either it makes us dull or it makes us very wishy-washy, and we become very, very flighty, very irresponsible, and, you know, we can't keep our checkbooks balanced, and we lose directions, and because I'm just so engrossed in God. And that's a complete misconception. Spirituality grounds you and anchors you in a way that your mind becomes a very obedient tool in your hand, rather than the master of you. So in many ways, the deeply spiritual people are actually even more effective. Because their minds are in their control rather than running around in a million places that they have no control over. And so there's nothing in the spiritual teachings that says thou shalt not get anything done. In fact, it's the opposite. In the Bhagavad Gita, it's a scripture, a treatise on getting things done. Doing exactly what you need to do with energy, with even in the midst of stress, in the midst of fear, in the midst of confusion, sleepless nights, but getting done what needs to get done. And so, absolutely, spirituality is something very positive to bring into our workplace, because if we do, a lot of things will shift. Number one, we'll stop looking at each other as competition. Most people think in business, the only competition is the other guy's company. And if that were true, it would be great. If our only competition were the other people making the same product under a different name, we'd be halfway there. We'd still, of course, have to eventually realize, ah, wait, they are us. Ah, wait, it's not about competing against them. But if we could even just be there, we'd be halfway there. The dilemma is that the competition in our workplace is about who's got a nicer cubicle, who's got the desk by the window, whose name comes first on the report or the research. And so there's actually all of this even infighting, which not only keeps us from being in a deeply beautiful spiritual place in the workplace, but it keeps us from being effective workers. And so if we brought more spirituality into the workplace, the workers would be spiritually uplifted, spiritually grounded, spiritually connected. They would then be literally, physically healthier. We actually know, I won't go into all the science, but we actually know that spiritual grounding and anchoring actually improves our immune system. We know it improves, obviously, our emotional well-being, our coping skills, our ability to not lose our tempers, but it also improves our physical well-being. So, this is why, for example, companies like Apple, Hewlett-Packard, McKinsey, company, you know, big, big companies that get things done, actually have meditation rooms. Apple pays people 30 minutes a day to meditate. Now, they don't have to, but you've got 30, if you were an Apple employee, you would have 30 minutes of time on the clock, paid time, to spend in the meditation room. Now you think, how many man hours, woman hours, a month, a year is Apple losing by these people sitting in the meditation room? They're not about spiritually uplifting humanity, they're about getting things done. But the science shows that people who are both grounded and uplifted spiritually are actually better at getting things done. They're actually more creative, more efficient, more effective, less likely to be confused or be confusing, less likely to lose their temper, less likely to be an inefficient, ineffective worker. So, even on just that most superficial level, spirituality is good in the workplace. But on a more deep level, If as employers or CEOs or owners of workplaces, if we can be spiritually uplifted to the point of recognizing that the bottom line is not about just profits, but it's actually about the ripple impact on the planet. And it's not just about money in my pocket, but it's actually about a sustainable model in the world. Well, then workers who are uplifted and connected and grounded are those who are going to be creative innovators for ways to take our working environment into being something that not only is beneficial for the company, but that is actually beneficial for the planet. Because the truth is, those two things are not mutually exclusive. Doing well and doing good are not mutually exclusive. Unless you've got tunnel vision. And so spirituality in the workplace is nothing but positive on every possible level that I can think of. So whether you are an employee or an employer or an owner or a CEO or an entrepreneur or whatever your work environment may be, the more spirituality you can bring into it, the better. Don't be afraid of it. It is not going to turn your workers into dull, listless, floating, flighty people. It's going to actually turn them into exactly what you as a company and we as a planet need. This brings to a close this hour of inspiration and transformation. Thank you so much for joining me. I'm so glad to be together with you all each week, and I look forward to being together again next Thursday, same time, on Om Times Radio.